Welcome to the Untold Tales audio anthology, written and narrated by Dr. Jeffrey A. Robinson. Sanctuary. Charles Gibson stood looking at the desolate terrain outside. The ground was barren, devoid of life, and the harsh, dry wind pushed dirt and dust around in lazy circles. No sign of life could be seen anywhere. Not even dead trees or dried grass marred the lifeless terrain. The sanctuary lay buried far beneath the surface, safe from the ravaging conditions far above. Long ago, more than a million people had sought shelter here. But climate change had increased. Nations collapsed. Then, after the last of the food crops from the surface ran out, there was no longer any desire for anyone here to return to the world outside. Gibson stared at the displays, lost in thought. Out there was the sun. Out there, whatever had become of centuries of non-interference with environment, and possibly out there was their future. Of course, he wasn't really looking through windows. The row of displays that appeared before him made it look as if he was up on the surface viewing the world outside. "Where are the others?" Charles asked. His tone was somewhere between earnest inquiry and demand. "I only see about half of our governance team." "Well," replied Vincent Cardona, who was the vice president of the committee and former CEO of the second largest company in the world. "Can you blame them, Charles? You didn't indicate that this meeting was an emergency, and it's been quite a number of years since we all met." "But I did," said Charles. "In fact, by the council's rules, I can only convene an emergency meeting. Just because some people aren't paying attention isn't an excuse for bailing out." "So what's the emergency?" asked someone. Whoever it was, his video was offline, and the AI had substituted a mechanical-sounding generic avatar in his place. Typical, thought Charles. "Yes," replied another fellow named Ellis. His response was such a total non sequitur that Charles audibly sighed. But Ellis continued, "Almost everyone has become accustomed to living their own lives without interruption. Why would they show up if they really don't need to? What could possibly be important enough to interrupt them?" Charles thought to himself. Ellis had been one of the early leaders here in the sanctuary, but what had motivated him had been fear. Fear of death, fear of being left behind, but mostly fear of missing out. The only way to convince Ellis to do anything was to convince him that he was at risk of being the last one to board the train. Charles' lips tightened, and for a moment his hands clenched into fists. "And there it is," he thought. "I haven't even told them anything, and they're already objecting. How can you tell people something when they don't want to listen?" And yet he held his tongue. "I need to wait for them to get it," he told himself. "If I push too hard, we'll all be doomed." "Listen, Charles," said Vincent. "Most of the others haven't responded because they don't feel like they need to. You try prying them out of their VR sims and imaginary worlds. There's nothing upstairs to look at, so why bother?" Vincent had been the CFO of a global asset management firm. Now he spent most of his free hours playing simulated robo-golf. Most of the souls in Sanctuary had been entitled billionaires in their families. Most had never worked a day in their lives, and they'd done little since they arrived except indulge themselves in endless VR simulations, enjoying or exploring imaginary worlds of their own design. Many hadn't left their sims in so long that Charles wondered if they even remembered the last time they'd seen the outside world. "What's so serious?" asked Vincent. Charles started to explain, but stopped himself. Unlike most of the residents under the mountain, he'd been a scientist and an engineer. He'd been on the design and logistics team for the original crew that had set up this facility under the Rockies. He hadn't bought his way in like most of the others. He'd earned it. He was allowed to enter only because he was indispensable at the time. Not so much anymore. In that sense, his authority was tenuous, hence his hesitation. "I don't like games," Charles blurted out, "or idle diddling. I always liked learning and working with my hands. Back when Sanctuary was set up, I was an engineer, not one of the privileged rich. I helped build this place. Sure, like you, I retreated from the world for a while after we arrived here. But I had a job, which was to see that things kept working. Nobody even wanted to think about being outside, and you're right. It was just too depressing to look at what was happening to the world. But when that started to intrude on our gilded cage, I had to pay attention. And if you haven't looked lately, while the world upstairs is slowly healing from a nearly mortal wound that we inflicted, things here haven't been getting any better." "Well, I, for one, don't find it an emergency that people here don't care about what's happening out there," said Vincent, waving his hand at the displays. "What do you expect? We're safe here. So what's the bloody crisis?" "Because we had a server failure yesterday," Charles finally said. There, he thought, now the cat's out of the bag. "We're not safe here. Not anymore." "So," said Ellis, "send a fucking repair bot."
"Easier said than done," said Charles.
"What are we going to use for parts?"
"Have you seen the parts depot?" asked Charles as he flicked a screen into view. "Here, this is a live feed."
"It's empty," said Ellis. "Where did everything go?"
"I think," Vincent said to Ellis, "that Charles is trying to tell us that in the last 4 centuries, we've used all the parts, or at least most of them. But then, Charles, why not have more parts printed?"
Ellis's facial expression said, "Jesus, Charles, you woke us all up for this?"
Charles continued, "We're out of resin, out of graphene, and the last vapor dep unit failed 6 years ago. Something breaks now, it stays broken."
Ellis seemed genuinely baffled.
6 years? Really?
Then, blinking nervously, he added, "It doesn't matter anyway. It's only 1 server out of 10,000.
"You don't understand," said Charles slowly. "The computers that house our minds were built with triple redundancy and hot standby. Systems are supposed to be constantly mirrored with one another, and in theory, a server can't go down unless all 3 systems fail simultaneously. When we built this place, we planned for everything to last 100 years, but it's been 400. Events like Tuesday's server failure that were once astronomically rare are now increasingly common. That server crashed while one node was undergoing maintenance, but when that node was offline, the second node experienced a memory problem, and a power supply failed on the third. More than 100 digital personalities were lost when it went down. They were essentially erased."
"But can't they be recovered?" asked Ellis. "Reload them from a backup."
"Not if the main server fails during mirroring. The 2 hot copies get corrupted, and the 3rd's too old to be current. When the servers go down, the people on that server simply go away. The dynamic history of what they were disappears."
Marguerite, who'd been quiet till now, spoke up. "And you expect more servers to fail, don't you? More people will permanently go offline or back to day 0 at best. That's why you called us here."
Before coming here, Marguerite had amassed a fortune in real estate and had grown up in a world where she expected not to be taken seriously. She'd learned quietly to listen to what others said and sit back while others wrestle objections to the ground, and then pounce when the time was right.
Am I correct, Charles?
Yes, Charles replied, relieved. I called this meeting because, while that one server was just the first, more will follow. If we don't do something, that will be the end that all of us will face.
Good, said Marguerite. Now we're getting to the heart of the matter. Go ahead and make your point, Charles. You have our attention.
Thank you, Marguerite, Charles gestured at his display wall, upon which swirled the image of a giant dust cyclone that seemed to fill an expanse hundreds of miles wide. This view, he said, is from cameras on an old radio tower in what used to be Kansas.
Ah, yes, the Great American Desert, muttered Marguerite.
Indeed, during the time everyone had been safely sequestered, the Dust Bowl of the 1930s had returned with a vengeance. What had once been America's breadbasket was now a wasteland that spanned an area about 500,000 square miles, about a quarter the size of the Sahara. Charles touched another button, and the scene on the displays changed so that they now overlooked ruins of cities, half submerged by the ocean that had risen more than 100 feet. Gesturing at the displays, Ellis said,
"This is exactly what Vincent meant. Everything you're showing us is just too depressing. Why would anyone want to even see this? What the fuck, Charles?"
"Because that's the real world," said Charles. "It's the world that we left, and the world we must now return to, like it or not."
"But it's not inhabitable," said Vincent.
For a moment, he actually sounded concerned. Charles paused. If he tried to explain how the melting of the ice caps and permafrost had released 600 gigatons of methane, far stronger greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, not a single one of the people here would understand. Global warming had increased far beyond what anyone had ever expected, and while it was leveling off and things were finally healing, it was, for all intents and purposes, a depressing, nasty, and brutish existence outside, and likely a very short one for an unprotected human. Charles visibly winced. Finally, he stood up, blacked out every screen but his main conversational display, and threw his hands up. "You know what? You're right. Things suck up there. I hid from the outside world for so long because of that. I hid it from you because of that. But now things are about to get bad down here, too." Everyone stared at Charles as if in shock. This isn't getting through to them, he thought. They'd all been businessmen. Vincent had traded commodities in the energy sector. Ellis had managed hedge funds and security exchanges. Marguerite had played at real estate, shuffling and cutting buildings and lands like a deck of cards. And they'd all been rich, back when those jobs had meant something, when money had any value. But none of them had any technical background. None of them had any real skills. They were absolutely the worst people to save from global collapse. "We need to act now and soon," Charles said. "Over the next few years, more servers will fail, and if we don't do something, eventually everyone in Sanctuary will die."
"Well, if that's your message, that the outside world is uninhabitable and we're all gonna die, then I'm done here," Ellis said as he stepped away from his view screen. "If anyone needs me, I'll be on my yacht, enjoying a virtual margarita under a virtual cabana on a virtual beach." Then his screen winked off as the connection dropped.
"No," thought Charles. "This can't be how it goes. I need more time. I need their cooperation. I need... Wait!" he called with more force and emotion than he intended. "We can fix this. I'm certain of it. We don't have much time, but we have to try. Things have What? Asked Marguerite. Spit it out.
Things have changed, Charles said. There's hope. There's still life out there. Charles touched the control panel, and a screen changed to show a seemingly endless expanse of verdant forest. This is a view of northern Canada. Since plants love carbon dioxide, trees have flourished in the northern regions of the world. Now, CO2 levels have begun to drop, and the skies are clear for the first time in decades. He changed the scene on the monitors, switching to a view of the ruins of northeast Russia, where the sun was setting. The scene was glorious, with red and purple clouds coloring a darkening blue sky. In the distance, fields of wild grain waved like surf. Charles continued, When I first decided to come back and look out at the world decades ago, the sky was ominous, dark gray, and the sun glowed with a deep, angry red. It took me a while to realize that the color was caused by smoke. Most vegetation in the tropic regions of the planet had dried out enough that massive fires raged, consuming everything that could burn. The smoke from all the fires just increased the carbon dioxide even more, accelerating global warming. I didn't see much green for years, but slowly the grass has returned. The skies are clear now, and the temperature's been dropping steadily. Vegetation is returning nearly everywhere. Marguerite and Vincent sat silently, listening. There's life out there, said Charles. It's struggling, but it's life. And while it hasn't seen humans in over 400 years, it's basically doing okay. It's had a long time to heal. It just needs a little help and a little more time.
So that's great, right? Vincent said after a long pause. The world has started to recover.
Charles nodded. Yes, he said, and now it's time for us to wake up and reclaim it.
Vincent frowned. It won't be easy, will it?
No, Charles said candidly. Our biggest obstacle will be air.
Why? Asked Vincent. What do you mean?
Well, much of the carbon dioxide released in the atmosphere was absorbed by the oceans. The carbon dioxide was converted to carbonic acid, and that made the oceans even more acidic. More than 50 years ago, the acidity of the oceans reached a critical point, and the primary species of phytoplankton started to die off. Since the majority of the oxygen in our atmosphere is produced by those tiny organisms, the amount of the oxygen in the air has been dropping dramatically, and most of the vertebrate life on Earth has started to die.
Wait, why weren't we told any of this? Asked Vincent.
But you were, replied Charles. The AI sends quarterly environmental reports to members of the governance committee and science advisors. But that's less than 100 people from the millions residing here. I bet none of you's read any of them for years.
Everyone else's eyes dropped to the floor or looked askance, but no one denied Charles' claims.
But don't trees produce oxygen, too? Said Marguerite. You showed us vast forests.
Yes, said Charles. But before the collapse, trees only contributed about 20% of the total oxygen in the air. Most of the oxygen came from marine life, plankton, algae, floating plants. The O2 in the atmosphere has dropped from 26% to about 6%. That's far less than what climbers could breathe on Mount Everest. It's mostly arid and lifeless out there. Places like the forest I showed you are not common. They're like little gardens of Eden that could fail at any moment. Actually, it's a miracle they already haven't. That's what we're trying to hang our hopes on.
Vincent opened his mouth as if to say something, but paused.
We'd need suits and rebreathers at first, said Charles. We could increase the oxygen supply by restoring varieties of acid-resistant phytoplankton in the oceans, but it would be a long-term project. We'd need a dispersion team on the coasts. The plankton cultures would disperse in ocean currents and spread. But until then, the first teams would have to live in dome-like structures with regulated air. It would take years, perhaps a few decades, but it's possible. I've run hundreds of simulations. Vincent frowned and glared at Charles and Marguerite. After a long pause, he asked, "And what are the alternatives again?" Charles shrugged and replied, "Dying here in sanctuary, as the servers fail one by one. If we don't try, eventually nothing will remain of this place except idle, rusting machines buried deep beneath the Rockies."
"Are you serious?" asked Margaret. "Those are our only options?"
Charles nodded. "Yeah. Frankly, I think we're lucky to have two options. We're not dead yet." A wave of guilt swept across him, and he worried that he'd waited too long. A few times he'd decided that the task of motivating everyone was just too great. But in the end, he'd decided he'd rather die outside living a real life than die here when his server crashed. Shaking his head, Vincent finally said, "Well, then, I guess we're just going to have to start up the meat printers." Charles shook his head. "Please don't call them that. The cloning facility is working fine, but unfortunately we can only resurrect a few people at a time. And we'll also need more biomass to grow additional bodies." Vincent sighed, and the three of them stared at one another for a while. "The first people who are reanimated," said Charles, "will have to gather and grow raw materials to reload the cloning vats. They'll have to do that to build up a population large enough to gather the materials we need to resupply the 3D printers. Then we can manufacture repair parts to keep the servers running until everyone can be reanimated. And we'll have to throttle that to avoid overloading the fragile ecosystem in which it's all taking place." Marguerite listened intently. "It'll take a lot of effort," said Charles, "but we can slowly restore sanctuary and build habitable quarters for people to live in. It'll be a delicate balancing act and a long, drawn-out process. There's a lot of risk, but we have to try." "You still haven't answered one question," said Vincent. "If you have all the answers, why'd you call this meeting?"
"Ah," said Charles. "Yes, that. As to the reason I called this meeting, I thought it was obvious. I need you to vote on who goes outside first."
The vote didn't go as Charles expected. Margarita voted for Charles. Vincent abstained. Alice voted against anyone going out. In the meantime, since the meeting had been convened, two other members of the council had replied to pings indicating they could attend as soon as possible, but were detained on multi-week excursions. One of them was an Amazonian safari. The irony wasn't lost on Charles. As the votes were tabulated, he sighed visibly. "It's like herding cats," he said to Marguerite. "They're just being who they are," she said, "alpha males. They won't be done until they pee on everything and mark it as theirs."
"Hell of a way to run a railroad," muttered Charles.
"I'm not familiar with that expression," said Marguerite. Charles flicked his screen back on and instantly muted the displays of the others, most of whom had paused their participation in a similar fashion as they stepped away to deal with other matters. He left Vincent's channel open in case he rejoined.
"It's just," he began, turning to Margaret, "can I be honest with you? Going upstairs is going to be dangerous. Even if the envirosuits keep people alive, we have to fix the oxygen levels. There's going to be a lot of risk."
"Yes, there's hope, and we've got to cling to that, but that doesn't mean we're in the clear."
Whoever we select for that initial team could be going on a suicide mission.
And if we send no one, said Marguerite, we'll all be headed there.
There'll probably be very little food, said Charles. In fact, that's quite likely. Most of it's probably not edible. The sanctuary's AI has documented that of the millions of species that existed when the sanctuary was built, most died in the first century after we arrived. Three-quarters of the remaining species died in the century after that. It's been estimated that there are as few as 20,000 species of plants and animals out there. There haven't been that few since pre-Cambrian eras, over 600 million years ago.
I don't get it, Marguerite said. You called us to ask to vote on who to resurrect, and then you tell us it's a death trap.
I'm starting to think Ellis is right. Why the fuck do anything? I'm starting to see why Ellis is so pissed with you.
Just then, Vincent came back online.
We can repopulate the human race, right? If we get enough biological material, all we have to do is reseed the ecosphere?
Yes, said Charles, but we can't hurry it. As a practical matter, it's going to take as long as it takes, and we'll need to do without a lot of stuff. We'll feel real hunger and real pain. We'll need to select subject matter experts. There are a few essential ones I've been communicating with. There's one fellow named Monty who does nothing but study and track the weather on the surface. He spent nearly all his time here refining his weather prediction models. There's another fellow, Soren, who's been cataloging the death of individual species as they become extinct. He knows best what's still up there and how endangered or edible it is.
Go on, said Vincent. This time, thought Charles, he seems engaged.
We can restart the oceans with genetically modified phytoplankton that can survive in more acidic water, superplankton that would generate far more oxygen than previous forms. Then we'd have to seed the oceans with as many of those strains as possible.
Radiolarians are good candidates because they're mobile and tend to surf ocean currents to new homes. We'd need cultures that were dinoflagellate resistant to reverse the effects of red tide. Still, even with those measures, we're talking decades before vertebrate life could survive.
But it could be done, right? Asked Vincent.
Of course, said Charles. Once we're reanimated, we could repopulate the whole planet with the biodiversity it lost. We probably wouldn't finish in our lifetimes, but we could create the teams to start the process. We would have to create a timeline to schedule when to reintroduce each species and get enough of the ecosphere back up and running to support the rest.
Wait, said Vincent. We're not all going up?
We can't, said Charles. At least not for a long while. Too many people would kill off what's little's up there. And if that first team fails to sustain the ecosystem around them, fails to collect enough biomass, fails to repair the server, fails at anything, well, that's it. No more resurrections. That's why we have to pick the right people for that first team. Perhaps a group of people, say a biologist, a repair tech, a scientist, a meteorologist, a geologist.
How many bodies could we resurrect with the current biomass that we have? Asked Marguerite.
About 6 to 8, said Charles, and we have enough food to provide them for a year or so until they can start growing their own. Fortunately, we have seed stock and samples of every life form we could collect before we all uploaded, but that will leave us with absolutely no biological material for the cloning facility until the team can acquire more. Like I said, the system throttles itself.
There's no fast answer. We just go up, do it right, and wait until it's time for the next step.
Well, then, said Vincent, that's the plan. One obvious candidate is Charles. I'm officially throwing my vote in with Charles. I'm assuming he'll vote for himself. That leaves you, Ellis, and two others. Ellis, are you there?
Charles looked over at Ellis's display. Ellis was indeed back online. He'd quietly reconnected to the session and had been listening for the last few minutes. The glare he gave Charles could have cut cold steel.
No, said Ellis, I'm not voting for you, Charles. You're not chairman, and it's not your decision.
That's right, replied Charles, but I'm acting chairman and have been ever since Pinkerton stepped down and retreated to his own private VR world, one where his wife and children managed to get here in time instead of dying in megastorms that ravaged the East Coast.
Charles had grown tired of arguing and explaining.
Look, he said brusquely to Ellis, I've given you all the information you need. I've sent you memos, I've announced meetings that you've avoided. And now that our survival is on the line, you can argue till you're blue in the face, but I'm not giving up.
What's your beef, Marguerite asked Ellis. You're way out of line.
Charles is right. We need to do something. We need to go upstairs.
Ellis glowered.
Finally, Vincent said, Ellis doesn't want to lose his immortality. He's afraid of resurrection. He clings to sanctuary.
Ellis grew angry and said, Shut up, all of you. This is all fucking ridiculous. I think most of the million souls here in sanctuary would prefer to carry on their digital lives until the power runs out, rather than face a far more certain death by returning to a physical existence that would almost certainly kill them.
Vincent growled at Ellis. By stalling on this vote, you're not just denying everyone the chance to find out. You're denying them the chance to even speak out. Of all the arrogant...
Strangely, Charles found himself in a place of calm as Vincent was escalating the matter with Ellis.
It doesn't matter what the others prefer, said Charles. The fact is, we aren't immortal. We can't stay here forever. But you're right, Vincent. We can't deny folks the chance to decide for themselves. But we do need to decide who to resurrect first in order to give them that choice, before more servers fail or the cloning facility does. If we lose the meat printer, as you call it, we're stuck here in virtual reality. Anyone who's afraid of death isn't going to cheat it by staying inside.
But isn't there anything else we can do, whined Ellis?
Ellis, what I'm saying is we need a small team, carefully chosen. A team to work their asses off. To get the plankton cultures going, the biomass collected, the food crops planted, to keep the cloning vats and parts printers functioning so the servers can be repaired. And if we're lucky, they'll endure long enough to do all that. If we succeed, we'll be able to bring the rest of us back, or at least anybody who wants that. But you're right. Whoever goes upstairs is leaving his or her safe existence behind. Some people, however, will have to stay behind.
This was not something Ellis wanted to hear. He rolled his eyes and moments later cut the connection.
So, who's going to do that? Asked Vincent.
Watch the surface, I mean.
I was hoping you'd ask, replied Charles. I have something to show you.
Ellis never did come around. Ironically, when Bank FC-9718 failed sometime later, he went offline permanently. In the meantime, Charles had set up a process to select 6 members for the upstairs team based on their ability to contribute meaningfully to a very specific but diverse set of goals. Not surprisingly, the final list included both Charles and Marguerite.
The rest of the team was made up of microbiologist Soren, the earth science expert Monty, a design engineer named Tucker, and a complexity theorist named Lee Kwang, a burly-looking fellow that everyone nicknamed Kong. Vincent had wanted to go, but after talking with Charles, they'd decided it was best for him to remain behind to serve as a liaison between the sanctuary and the ground team. Charles consoled Vincent, who said, "It's all right. I know I have to wait my term, and I think I'll be good at this." Charles was glad that after he was resurrected, he'd still be able to count on Vincent. After all six bodies had been successfully grown, they all gathered for the first downloading of a digital mind back into a human form since the founding of Sanctuary. While the technology had been perfected long ago, it had only been tested experimentally. The tech had been taken for granted when Sanctuary was built. Of course it would work, people thought and said back then. But it had not been used in 4 years, and Charles found himself shrouded with dread and worry about whether or not it would function properly. Failure of the system meant that he would die. Dozens of residents watched the live feed to the outside as the procedure was performed on Charles, and then on each of the others. The six of them each took a full day to recover in the cloning chamber before donning their environmental suits and heading out to the small collection of domes outside that repurposed maintenance robots had built for them to serve as their new home. Charles gulped audibly when one of the bots stumbled and fell, but it got back up on its own and continued to work at building the next shelter. Gradually, he felt his brand new throat relax. Except for the small cloning chamber where they would deliver biomass to restock the machines, none of them would ever return to Sanctuary again. That's when the real work began. Over the next few years, the team flourished. Local soils were reseeded with beneficial bacteria, crops were planted, and some even thrived. Drones flew out of sight, dropping plankton into distant oceans, while drought-resistant grasses and plants were seeded across vast, barren plains. Every so often, they stumbled across a place where life had managed to flourish, small enclaves of green, but life nevertheless. They held those places to be somewhat sacred, and they were marked as off-limits for all but a few special occasions. In addition to serving as the primary contact for the Reborn, as they now called themselves, Vincent had turned out to be quite the biologist. Lately, he'd taken a special interest in recharging Rhizobia and Agrobactis bacterial samples that Charles had collected. The team was rewarded with a tub of hyper-healthy soil for their burgeoning vegetable garden. Marguerite turned out to be a remarkable ecologist, and they had a small party when they harvested her first leguminous vegetables. In a way, Vincent felt envious, as Charles and Marguerite seemed happy together. And yet, as each day on the surface observation outpost passed, he watched them grow older. One day, years later, after a long repair session with Surface Cam number 42, Charles appeared before the camera looking bedraggled and lost. "Marguerite passed away today," he said. "I'm sorry," said Vincent. "I'm not," replied Charles. "It's the way of things here. We enjoyed a good life. We saw a lot of sunrises and sunsets. We watched flowers bloom again, and We work for everything we did to help nature rebuild this world. I'm proud of her in ways you cannot imagine. Vincent smiled, and that was how he wanted to remember her as well. Out here, Charles continued, I discovered that Marguerite was so much more than her virtual self. She was warm, whimsical, and full of life. She was my dearest companion. She used to relish waking up each morning to breathe in the fresh air. And it is fresh now, Vincent, and it'll get fresher. I wish you could be here to smell it. It smells like dirt and 1,000 faraway places. It smells like life and possibility. He paused. I hope you can join us soon. Me too, said Vincent. Charles smiled, and when he did, cracks formed at the corner of his eyes and his skin stretched over his face like old leather. There's a belief in North American native culture that the more we're connected to the earth, the more the earth returns life to us, and in that sense, we don't die. Marguerite hasn't died, Vincent. She's just gone on her way. And you've served our mission many years diligently and honorably, and I owe you a debt for you persuading the other two council members to allow us to be the first. Tomorrow, I'll be delivering enough biomass to the cloning facility for the next two crew members to be resurrected. That'll make 30 of us now. We've grown into a comfortable little village out here. Vincent smiled wanly. I thought you'd like to know, Charles, that we reached a milestone today. Marguerite was not here to tell you herself as she wanted, but tomorrow I'll give authorization for you to begin printing. Vincent was gobsmacked. Jesus, Charles, it's been decades. I assumed it was just a sacrifice, Charles finished. Yes, I know. You gambled your life on our success. This is our way of saying thank you. We wouldn't be here without you, and now... A face moved blurrily on screen, in and out of focus. It was that of a muddy, distracted-looking 6-year-old girl, complete with matted hair and a snotty nose. Colette, say hi to Mr. Vincent. You remember Vincent, don't you?
Hi, Mr. Vincent, said Colette. Can you come out and play?
Good girl, said Charles. Now go clean up. Vincent will be here tomorrow, and he can play with you all day. Charles turned to the display. We have clean water now. It took a while, but there will be more than enough to drink when you get here. We'll make a go of it. The two of them talked, mostly about nothing, until the sun set. As Charles's face moved into silhouette, Vincent gazed longingly at the carefree scampering of Colette and the rich orange glow of the setting sun that enveloped her like a halo. As Vincent made his way to the printing room, he found himself in an odd mood. Will I feel it, he wondered? The splitting of my soul between silicon and flesh? Will it be like reincarnation? Like a fictional transporter beam? Who will I see when I look back at myself from above? Will that be the real me? Will I seem alive or like a ghost trapped forever in an accursed mirror? Will there be anything to look back? The printer hummed into action, and for the first time, Vincent realized that the printer room he was currently standing in didn't exist at all. It was just a simulation. Nevertheless, he led his virtual body onto a raised platform in the shiny, well-lit room and waited for the scan. Moments later, light exploded in his eyes, and the sound that filled his ears was the most beautiful cacophony of chirps and flutters, whirs and buzzes, and a distant whistling sound he couldn't quite make out. It smelled like rust, oil, resin and electricity. It smelled real. Vincent opened his eyes and struggled to sit up. Charles came over and hugged Vincent while he was still dazed. "Welcome to Earth, Vincent, and happy birthday." Vincent stood shakily and unsteady. For a moment, he just stared out through the open doors at the horizon. In the distance, he saw a row of giant, majestic conifers. Then he looked back at Charles. "Time has treated you well, my friend," he said. "Thank you for the privilege." Charles gestured up at the sky. "The privilege has always been here," he said, "but we nearly squandered it by taking so long. When we saw what we'd done, we ran away and hid from our sins." Vincent breathed in deeply and crossed his arms as he looked forward. "Never again," he said. "We'll be better shepherds this time." Charles patted Vincent on the shoulder. "Good shepherds indeed," he said. "Now let's get you some dinner. It's not much, but it's real food, and I'm damned proud of it. It's humble, but it's plentiful." Smiling, he raised his arm in the direction of the camp and said, "Come, let's dine together." During the meal, Charles explained that with recent improvements, they'd be able to focus more on collecting biomass so sanctuary residents could be downloaded more frequently. After dinner, everyone gathered in the largest dome and talked, hugged, laughed, and wept. At length, Charles got up and excused himself. "I'm going for a stroll," he said. "You should rest, Vincent. The first day back is always hard." Then he walked off into the setting sun, toward a place in the meadow where the flowers grew particularly tall and beautiful, where the air was cool and clean in the shadow of the trees. He picked two flowers, all he dared, and took them to where Marguerite lay in the earth. Suddenly he remembered the words of an old proverb an associate had once shared in a faraway place when the world was dying. "Death is not to be feared," it said, "by one who lives wisely." "You lived wisely, my love," Charles said as he laid the flowers gently down. "Now I must live bravely until we meet again."
Thank you for listening. As you know by now, we love our listeners, fans, patrons, and supporters. Please let us know what you think of our podcast and our stories. The best way to do that is to subscribe to our podcast at untold-tales.com. By doing so, you'll be added to our mailing list so you can be notified of upcoming episodes, blogs, and other information. Thanks again for listening, and have a great day.